Case of the day, Behavioral Institute versus Hobart City. Mr. Ruff.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. The Behavioral Institute sought a use variance from the city of Hobart for the purpose, this was a former psychiatric hospital, and to use the former psychiatric hospital as a residential treatment center for troubled youth. We passed the BZA, approved the use variance. Now, in every other county except St. Joseph County and Lake County, the approval of the Board of Zoning Appeals would be all we would needed to get the use variance. However, the Indiana legislature had set out a special requirement for use variances and other land use, special use exemptions and so on in Lake County and St. Joseph County, that they also had to be approved by the Common Council. So this would be the Hobart Common Council. Hobart Common Council turned down the use variance. We claimed that the Hobart Common Council violated fundamental principles of due process. It was their position that as a legislative body they did not have to follow due process procedures, and also denied that there were violations. We followed the special statutory procedure in Indiana, an expedited procedure, the trial court, which would be the first trial court, the Superior Court, agreed with us, said there were violations of due process, and granted the zoning. There was an appeal. The Court of Appeals said, yes, there were violations of due process, but we are not going to grant the zoning. We are going to send this back to have a hearing comporting with due process. In the interim, between the case being sent back and the hearing being set up, the building was sold to a third party, totally unrelated party, which our position was mooted the entire relief granted to us by the Court of Appeals, and then we filed a 1983 action in the federal court. The district court dismissed the 1983 action, saying that we were aware of the harm to us at the time that we were denied the zoning by the Common Council, that under general principles, when you're aware of your injury, even though you have a right to appeal in the state court system, your federal court of action arises, cause of action arises. I think that is really the crux of this case. As I've looked through the rather complicated legal and factual issues here, the question becomes is whether we had the right, in fact the duty, to seek a determination by Indiana of its regulatory scheme that it had set up in two counties for use variances and other such variances from the zoning laws. This was a comprehensive scheme. Although it only applied to two counties, it applied to every governmental entity in those counties, including the counties and the cities. It had not been interpreted whether this was a legislative function or a quasi-judicial function like the Board of Zoning Appeals were throughout Indiana. It's our position that there's really two lines of authority that say that in such an instance where we are not saying that there was a violation of due process under well-established law, for instance, it had already been established that the Common Council sat as a quasi-judicial body rather than a legislative. In that instance, then we would have a 1983 action because the law is established. The state has interpreted its comprehensive scheme for property management, property being the quintessential local issue for states, unless there's a federal interest in the land, and there was no federal interest in this land. If that had been the case, they had already made that establishment, the 1983 action should have arisen at the time we were denied. But that had not been determined by the state. And under the cases in this circuit, we cited several from the Seventh Circuit, cited a district court case, there are very clear statements that what is at issue is not the application of well-established statutory scheme, but rather the interpretation of the state's regulatory scheme for law, or zoning and regulatory scheme for land use, that the state court must make that decision. It is also absolutely consistent with another line, another principle, not necessarily a 1983 principle, which is Burford abstention. And
before you get to abstention, counsel, what was the nature of the certiorari argument that you were making in the state court when you originally took that action to get the common counsel's action reviewed in the state court?
We cited actions that were inconsistent with procedural due process as had been established by the state court law for boards of zoning appeals, and said that same principle applied.
But that was a federal due process, procedural due process claim, that the common counsel's action was quasi-judicial and therefore certain federal procedural due process rights attached, those weren't afforded, and therefore your client's rights were violated.
That the rights, yes, but the rights that had been established, that we argued, were the rights that had been established by state court cases, saying that, frankly, I don't remember if the ultimate basis of those state court claims was the Indiana Constitution or the federal Constitution, but there were state court cases which said that boards of zoning appeals sat as quasi-judicial bodies.
Right. I understand that that's a state court case law, but right, based on federal due process principles.
Yes. We said that federal due process rights required.
So you were making a federal due process claim in that certiorari action and could have at that time lodged a 1983 complaint in the state court or in federal court.
Our position, though, was that there was a question. We were making federal due process claims, but there was a question whether the state had the right to make the determination as to whether that action was a legislative action or was a quasi-judicial.
Sure, but the state courts have concurrent jurisdiction over Section 1983, and you could have joined with your certiorari action a complaint for due process violations under Section 1983.
In the state court. Absolutely.
And since you didn't, the cause of action had accrued, was running, and this action is barred by the statute of limitations.
Well, the point, yes, we could have joined the 1983 action. We did not in the quasi. But what happened with the state court is the state court gave us relief. So that the relief the state court gave us was that there was no that due process required that the was required, but not that there we were entitled to the zoning. The state court sent us back to have a new hearing. So at that point, it hadn't even been determined whether we had been denied due process. We had been denied due process, but we had no injury, because if the state court remedy had been allowed, had we gone through the state court remedy, we would have been granted relief. In other words, the 1983 action became moot because of the relief granted by the state court, which was to go back and do it again and have it done right. So had we gone back, and that's the twist in this case, had we gone back and made the argument, because it hadn't been sold, and made an argument and had a due process hearing in front of the court with the building still there, so it wasn't a moot action, we would have been granted the relief. We would have been granted relief by the state court. So any 1983 action we had filed would have been moot. Because if in a hearing before the Board of Zoning Appeals, before the Common Council, the rehearing, if they had granted us the zoning, we were whole. If they had denied the zoning, we had a hearing, and then we would have had to appeal it further. In other words, we had relief that was granted, and the relief would have mooted a 1983 action in any event. So that's the point of this. And of course, we didn't need a 1983 action normally, because if had the court granted what we expected, what we had hoped, would say we got the zoning, we were made whole.
Well, you wouldn't have got attorney's fees out of that.
That's correct. I would not.
1983 would have been the only vehicle for getting attorney's fees.
Right. We would not have got, but we would got what my client essentially wanted was the zoning. What the court did to us was say, go back and have a rehearing, which we would have, except the building was sold, which we think mooted it. So we got relief. So had there been a 1983 or any other state court action or whatever actions in addition to the certiorari procedure, those were mooted by the decision of the court. So that we followed the relief given by the court. So whether we joined the 1983 or not, we were granted relief. And it is only when that relief failed that, as our position, the 1983 action arose. Not as an extension of what originally, of the original action. The original action was taking care of the certiorari. Because now we have a determination that we were entitled to due process, that due process was not granted to us. We had a remedy, but the remedy failed because the building was sold to a third party and then it became meaningless. Then we had an injury. So it's our position that, and it took a little time to work through kind of the, and what I think is maybe the basic clarity of the position, at least setting it out as clearly as I can, that at that point is when our 1983 action arose. And even if we had filed one previously or any other action with the writ of certiorari, those would have been mooted by the state court's remedy. And when that state court remedy failed, it had now established that we had a due process violation and we had an injury because we had no right, with no way to go back and right that wrong with this building. And that is when the 1883 action arose.
Just so I understand your position, Mr. Ruff, do I understand you to say that when the Superior Court, the Indiana Court of Appeals remands to the Common Council for a new hearing, that relief is granted? Do you consider that relief after having the initial success at the trial level?
It was the relief. It was not the relief we wanted. We wanted the Court of Appeals to give us the zoning. But it was a relief allowed under the statute, and we followed the statutory procedure. So we had the right now to go back and to have a hearing comporting with due process. And we thought we could win in front of with a due process hearing.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Ruff. Ms. Conrad.
May it please the court, counsel. There are two points that I'd like to make today. First, that the district court properly construed the Institute's cause of action for the 1983 action to accrue and beginning to accrue on February 21st, 2001, when the council denied its petition for a use variance.
When they instituted their action to challenge that, which was a month later, they filed a state court action. They alleged a violation, among other things, of their federal due process rights. Now, they didn't say anything about 1983, but why couldn't their complaint be read to allege a 1983 cause of action at that time?
Why could their complaint not have been raised at that time, Your Honor?
No, I know they didn't specifically say we're raising a 1983 objection here, but they didn't mention that, but it seems like what they were saying was a 1983 action.
What, Your Honor, the 1983 claim, in order to bring a 1983 claim, you have to allege a violation of federal law or constitutional law, which is what they did when they brought their writ of certiorari petition within the 30 days after the denial by the Institute. Those are the same federal constitutional claims that they're making in this present instance. So they could have brought that 1983 action concurrently with that state court proceeding, and that is what precisely
I know
what
they could have. That would have been a really wise thing for them to have done, but they didn't do it. But why couldn't you look at what they did do and say, really, this is all this notice pleading and everything, but what they said was enough to let everybody know that they were claiming a 1983.
Well, that action
back in 2001.
Correct, and that action would now be time barred because it is.
No, it wouldn't be. Not if they had originally alleged the 1983 violation back in March of 01. It had been timely. There's no question about that.
Correct.
So what I'm saying, why can't you read the complaint that they filed alleging due process violations as a 1983 action at that time in 01?
That case was resolved in March of 2003. That's not the complaint that you have in the record before you.
Counsel, let me try it this way. What sort of a remedy is certiorari in the state court?
The remedy that they would have in certiorari is to review the takings claim as well as to review the process that was given by the council with regard to their petition for the land use.
It's a limited writ remedy designed to get the action in the tribunal below, the common council, before the state trial court.
Correct.
And limited to that record. Isn't
correct.
That right?
That's correct.
And is that similar or different to a Section 1983 claim?
It would be substantially the same claims as the underlying claims to the 1983 action because of the constitutional claims that are being raised. The 1983 is only the vehicle for those claims.
Right, and I understand that the arguments made can be similar, but the remedies, are they the same or different?
The only remedies that I would see that would be different would be the attorney's fees.
Can you get damages in a certiorari action?
There was also the raising of the constitutional law claims, and those claims, any kind of damages were responded to by the Indiana Court of Appeals in that proceeding.
The certiorari action is limited, is it not, to a remedy that addresses what was done in the Common Council? In other words, remand to the Common Council for a do-over, essentially.
You're correct.
Right. So unless there's specifically pleaded a 1983 claim for damages and attorney's fees, a certiorari action itself, unless there is an additional claim under 1983, itself is not an appropriate vehicle for obtaining 1983 relief such as damages and attorney's fees.
That's correct.
Okay.
In essence, what our argument is that that 1983 claim could have and should have been brought at the time of the injury or the injury that the institute had notice of. It was at the time that the initial decision maker, which was the council, had arrived at their definitive position with regard to the petition, and it's when they inflicted the actual injury, the concrete injury, and those claims could have been made at that point in time. Even if you were to accept the institute's position that they wouldn't have a claim of action until the rehearing before the council, which occurred in December 17, 2003. At that point in time, the building was sold, and they had no property interest. There was no property interest. Any property interest the property interest in the complaint that's before you was not even alleged in the complaint. The property interest, as they have cited in their brief to you, was only for a contract that would have been conditioned upon having the land use approved by the council in the way that they were seeking, and that expired. It was a condition for that. When that expired, so did, and that actually had expired again prior to the hearing to be reheld before the council.
When is the constitutional injury complete? At the time that the Common Council denies the variance application, or later when judicial review of that action is completed?
It is complete at the time that the Council reviewed their petition.
What if it is capable of being mooted by subsequent relief?
The Institute could have had taken separate action with regard to any kind of takings claims, the 1983 claims, before having brought this particular action.
This really isn't a takings claim, is it?
Excuse me?
This really isn't a takings claim.
That is not the way that we have understood this case, and that's the way we had understood it, and we briefed it in front of the district court. When we go through and looked at the complaint, the allegations that that were made in the complaint alleged substantive due process violations under the 14th Amendment, procedural due process violations under the, under 1983, and equal protection violations under 1983. And the takings claims, again, you would have to set forth some type of property rights from which they're being deprived. Those facts were never pleaded by the Institute. The only reference to any kind of takings claim that was made by the Institute was reliance on the Midwest case as well as the Williamson County case. And when they relied on those cases in their argument, they didn't rely on them in terms of trying to make any kind of analogy that their claim was also a takings claim, but they relied on them to suggest that the statute of limitations doesn't begin to accrue until after some kind of judicial finding of the relief that they were seeking. It was in the district court's decision that as they analyzed the takings claims, that those would also be precluded by the statute of limitations. And so consequently, if you look at the district court decision, the only thing that they saw with regard to the takings claim and how it was presented to them, that the only similarities that they could find with regard to the reliance of those cases were that they both generally dealt with zoning kinds of issues, and it really didn't apply to the 1983 actions that were being raised before them. The Institute, the other point that we wanted to make here today before the court was with regard to the takings claim, and that takings claim was really never properly pleaded before the district court. They didn't raise any kind of factual allegations with regard to that takings claim. Without those factual allegations supporting that claim, that claim would fail before them. The also with regard to the takings claim, the Institute's complaint only dealt with the procedural due process violations. What they were trying to do in their complaint was to stop the council from having a rehearing. It wasn't to assert any kind of takings claim. Had that been an actual takings claim, then we wouldn't see the school as a party to this action, and the school wouldn't be a party to any kind of 1983 action either. That point in the complaint made it also a little bit confusing in terms of trying to understand what remedies that they were seeking with regard to the complaint. Since the Institute has failed we respectfully request the court to affirm the district court's decision, and that we thank you for the honor of presenting our arguments before you today.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Conrad. Mr. Ruff, your time has expired, but you may have a minute if you have a short rebuttal.
Judge Sykes, it's our position, because there was the interpretation of a comprehensive state scheme for land use, that the constitutional violation occurred when the Indiana Appellate Court found that these common councils had to act with procedural due process rather than with as legislative bodies, and that this was a decision that federal courts allowed to the state.
That was just a ruling on the legality of what the common council did. What the common council did was complete when it was done.
Well, our position was that the issue that was raised was whether they had to act as a quasi-judicial, or cases come up to courts in individual, phrased as individual litigants, not for whole statutory schemes, but it did raise the issue as to whether due process had to be required in these schemes, and they did establish a precedent, and the precedent is precedent for Indiana. So our position was that the taking, that is when the constitutional violation occurred. We were granted a remedy, and when that remedy failed, then we had a right to go to a 1983 action. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rupp. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement. The court will